Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. This is the Friday live edition for those of you watching on YouTube. For those of you listening on audio, we're not quite live, but we are not that far in the past. Today, I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, joined by Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm okay, Nicholas.
Always good to have you on the show. Today, we're going to be talking about a new voice joining the chorus of criticism against BEE. We're also going to be speaking about the MK Party and its protest against foreigners in jobs. We're also going to be talking about water. And lastly, we're going to be talking a little bit, if we have time, about NASFIS and paying back the money. So let's get started off. NGO Open Secrets has written a report talking about South Africa's poor economic condition. The fact that the economy has barely grown in the last, 15 years, not in any serious way since about 2010, 2011. They have many criticisms of as for why this has happened, why our economy has not grown. But one of the things they include in their report criticizing BEE or criticizing the slow state of economic growth is BEE. Open Secrets says, instead of genuine broad-based empowerment of the black majority, it has become a system that privileges existent or aspirant elite and has not translated into a transformation of power in corporate South Africa. Empowerment became entwined with the state and abused the period of state capture benefiting politically connected individuals. Politicians and bureaucrats manipulated tenders using BEE status as a front to funnel contracts to friends, family, or political allies. In this way, contracts for state-owned entities enriched politically connected figures without the delivery of services. They say there are numerous examples, and I'm sure we can all think of some, but they, highlighted one to do with PRASA and the ordering of trains. The Open Secrets report goes on to say, BEE has done little to shift the racial makeup of the corporate sector, pointing out that by these metrics that are always drummed up who occupies the top management positions, that those are still held mostly by white people. While the majority of the population faces constant constraints to accessing jobs, entrepreneurship, and markets, access to state power and contracts has become a path to accumulation and opportunity. They go on to say that BEE had noble goals. They say that transformation was the right goal, but it was applied in a very narrow fashion, benefiting a small elite and doing nothing for most South Africans. Worse, government has used it as a fig leaf to hide the fact that few other efforts have been made to change the nature of the economy, always built to the benefit of a small group of people. Now, I'm not sure if I'd agree entirely with every single way they've positioned that and phrased that, but broadly speaking, that I think is exactly correct, Terence. And it's interesting to see yet another group joining in, I think, the position we've had for a very long time, which is that BEE is not making South Africans better off, except for this very small group of people who are politically connected. Professor William Gumede from the Wits School of Governance Business School, I can't remember which one he said. Anyway, Wits is also quoted again here, as he has been in past stories, talking about how he reckons about R1 trillion has gone to this small group of maybe 100 people who have benefited from BEE. Terence, what do you make of all this?
Look, I think that yes, we are seeing a sea change. More people are, and more groups and more interests are willing to point out that the emperor has no clothes. So it's good to at least see the holy cow of not being slaughtered, at least being led into the abattoir. Comment when we talk about the way it's applied, because this is the standard defense that, you know, it was a good idea, but badly applied, is that this sort of policy invariably is, I think, going to end up like this. If you incentivize something, an immutable characteristic like skin color or like gender, they're good business, capitalize on it. And unfortunately, this has, I think, come at some very significant costs, not least of which is that real entrepreneurship seeing an opportunity, taking a risk, the sort of sink or swim, or, you know, boats have been burnt type logic, simply fell into the background. Now, something like the various industrialists programs, I think that they compound this, because, you know, because intrinsic to that is almost like, well, the we want to have the benefits of this, but we'd like the state to take the risks and, if necessary, to take the knock. That's not an advisable path towards resilience. Many very successful business people fail multiple times, and you live, you learn. I think Richard Branson was one of them. So yeah, you know, this simply cannot be done better. And I think that to the extent that the state has a role to do through some sort of industrial policy, far more effort should be put in, first of all, just to making South Africa's fundamentals more business conducive, rather than giving carve outs to particular types of business people. Make sure that everybody has a good road network, rather than trying to stack your firms with racially balanced staff profiles that make more sense to an official with a spreadsheet than to someone actually trying to operate a business in the real world. Right. Ensure there is a proper skills pipeline through an education system that teaches numeracy, literacy, and facilitates problem solving. But you know, very, very good that this is now that the cow is on the road to the abattoir.
Yes, no, that's it's very welcome news. I think something that seems to be gotten right here is the link between a lack of growth and a lack of transformation. This is key. Is, you know, if your economy is growing at 7%. There's this sort of fantasy out there among some of the defenders of BEE, or some of the people who are at least, you know, they may not be super keen on BEE, but they're also nervous about the sort of alternatives of what happens if you dump it. Does that mean you just leave? Is all the money going to go to the people who have already made it, and you know, everyone else is just going to be left behind, and it's just going to, I don't know, entrench white privilege or whatever. This is the kind of thought that you get from some defenders of BEE. The thing is, if your economy is growing at 7%, it can't grow at 7% unless it's also empowering Black South Africans, because there just aren't enough white South Africans really to benefit from that. Too much of the economy is made up of Black South Africans who run businesses, who have university educations, who are, you know, have entrepreneurial spirit and are eager and ready to get involved and pull themselves up the business ladder or the wealth ladder, if only given the opportunity. And all BEE has done really is mess with meritocracy, not to the benefit of Black people, but to the benefit of this politically connected group. And I think it's very important to understand that, economic growth is a form of transformation. It is a form of changing the way the country looks, of allowing millions of more people to escape poverty, of just creating more wealth that can be used for everything. Taxes, if your economy is growing, that means you have more wealth to tax from, in absolute terms. It means that you can, you know, spend that money on various social services. It means that there's more people with resources who can build their own houses, who can buy private medical aid so they don't have to use government services. There's just so many positive knock-on effects that come from economic growth. And that is why it's very important that, we understand that it's not BEE or nothing. It's if you drop the things that with the whole back growth, you actually further the cause of transforming South Africa into a wealthy, more equal, more prosperous society.
Well, I think what you're getting at there is the choice is misstated. It's growth or nothing. Right. And while growth may not solve every problem by its own, you know, there are it is the foundational condition. Look, let me say something that might be quite heretical. The perch on which I sit, I think trade unions are actually a very positive thing. If you have a growing economy, that's one of the means that ensures
more people are getting employed.
Well, and that ensures that benefits, you know, reach the lower levels. Although, be careful, because trade unions also have their own access to grind, and you know, God bless them for that. The problem is that, well, we are just getting poorer every year. I would say you could sort of draw a line, and the thing that really whacked South Africa was the global financial crisis. We never recovered from that. Other emerging middle income countries did. South Africa did not.
Yes, no, and it's very clear. You go look at our economic growth figures. Mm-hmm. The slowdown 2008, that financial crisis coincides with the election of Jacob Zuma, the shift away from some of the positive policies of the Thabo Mbeki era, the intensification of many of the National Democratic Revolution policies, cadre deployment, doubling down on BEE, even more strength to the unions, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the consequences are that all these years later, what, nearly 20 years later, 17 years later, we are poorer, more unequal, and with failing government
and services. Angrier, I think, is another one.
And angrier too, yes.
And I think that goes across whatever divisions you want, between the poor and the more affluent, between across racial boundaries, although remarkably restrained in that respect given our history, between, you know, those on the inside and those on the outside, and just generally, you know, general sense of frustration.
Yeah. And you know, the reality is, if you still believe that we need extra incentives to help the poor, that simply having economic growth is not good enough, you can do means tested empowerment.
Yeah.
You say, okay, yeah, exactly. we'll give benefits to those who are poor rather than to those who are black. And you know, as the defenders of BEE often point out, you know, there's a correlation that you can from our past of race and poverty, right? Most poor people in South Africa are black. I don't know why everyone is so scared about this relatively small group of poor white South Africans potentially benefiting from an empowerment policy. It doesn't seem like a huge cost when the benefit is that empowerment policies will then go to the people who are actually poor.
On that, there are white beneficiaries of things like RDP houses and social grants. In fact, the one
you've made before.
Yeah, one of the great game changers of post-apartheid South Africa, which comes with all of its buyer bewares on it in terms of sustainability and whatever, is the social grant system. South Africa's rolled out a very extensive welfare state, free basic services, RDP houses, social grants and whatever. And those are actually remarkably colorblind. Get this thing by virtue of, the fact that you need it. And I don't know if anyone's actually done a breakdown, but yeah, you know, there are people of all races who, you know, go and collect their social grants, and you know, more strength to them is what I say. That's something I really don't mind my taxes going to. Believe me, there's a lot that I do mind my taxes going to, and I also do mind the amount that goes off my earnings into my taxes. Just saying.
Yes, although that's a can of worms that I think we should stay away from now, so that we don't get too fired up. But anyway, okay, let's move on to our next story. And you know, as we say time and time again, we do these surveys every single year, looking at what South Africans consider to be some of the most important issues in the country. And the thing that just overwhelmingly comes back, and not just from us, but basically anyone who surveys South Africans, is that unemployment is the very big concern. I think one of the reasons we're in the political situation we're in, though, is that there's a lot of disagreement amongst the general public as to why exactly unemployment is so high. You know, there are people like us who blame labor regulations, the unions, overly high taxes, et cetera, et cetera. But there are others who blame, for example, there being too many illegal immigrants taking all the jobs. You hear this quite often. I think it's a very common sentiment that seems to be expressed in KZN. And we had some evidence of this recently when the MK party, with a protest of about 300 people, blocked some roads south of Durban, and then went from sort of business to business, they say, looking to root out those who are flouting employment practices or legislation, but more specifically, they were targeting companies for potentially hiring undocumented foreigners. The leader of the protest said, we notified companies we would be coming to root out those in flouting employment laws. We have been reliably informed that some companies are not paying adequate salaries and wages. It's something we condemn. And they said that they were suspicious that logistics companies in the area were known to employ foreign drivers. And they said that they would be going to the market and doing spot inspections. So this, as far as I'm concerned, is basically just kind of vigilantist bullying and, you know, sort of taking the law into your own hands. One of the people who attended the protest is a 28-year-old woman who said she has recently been retrenched from a textile company. She said, quote, it's not fair what they did to us. Another challenge was the way in which the company prevented its employees from joining unions. We are being silenced. What's interesting about this, Terence, is you sort of, as is what one, I guess, would expect from MK, we were saying in the pre-show discussion, it's kind of a bit of a jumble of all issues. You know, they're worried about illegal immigrants taking jobs, but at the same time, it's also a protest against unemployment, but it's also kind of a kind of mafia-esque shakedown, and it's about wages, and it's about this, and these issues are sort of all connected, but, you know, I don't know, what do you make of this?
MK is a textbook example of a populist movement. I say movement rather than party because I think a party would have more structure. Now, in terms of populist theory, well, the various theories, but one of them is that populism unites a very charismatic leader, Zuma. And, you know, for those people who are fond of saying, well, he's so unpopular, no, he's a cult figure amongst people who like him. He just may not be, they may not be the people you want at your dinner parties, but, you know, let's try and see things in a more holistic picture.
And they are, to be fair, they are a relatively small group of the country. It's like 20% of the country yeah. is really keen on Zuma and everyone else doesn't like him.
Sure, but that 20% is the part it appeals to. You know, if this is the kind of thing you like, this is what you like. Secondly, this is not a party with structures and succession plans and you know, systems to go through. It's essentially a grievance machine about one person. And the other characteristic of populism is that it unites this mass of people who feel disenfranchised with their avatar, who is the leader, and that's, you know, Zoom. There was a bizarre video of Carl Niehaus chanting like something out of a cult horror movie. Yeah, we are Imshalozi, and Imshalozi is us. That is actually very, very. That's a very populist message. Okay, so what is it? Yeah, so this isn't a campaign with a defined goal. It's a expression of grievance about sort of everything in general, but nothing in particular. Whatever leaves you feeling frustrated, aggrieved, like an outsider, is something that you can that you can buckle onto this campaign. And, you know, foreigners are the instinctive lightning rod. But yes, you know, also, well, I have a job and I work for someone else. Well, you're not paying me enough. And unemployment, because, you know, because no one's really in favor of unemployment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think, you know, and I don't think that you can actually see a solution here, because populist movements don't do solutions. The idea is kind of, well, once the righteously mobilized people takes over, you know, all things will fall into line. And then, you know, when everything just falls apart, you sort of end up looking for an enemy to blame. So in that sense, watch the space. A recurrent concern for me is this sort of focus on foreigners. And the reason for that is not just because I think it's very tacky and very sad, but because these things jump borders. You know, today it's the Somali shopkeeper, then it's the Afrikaans farmer, then it's the Indian accountant. And then it's the people from Venda and so and so and so and so on and so on and so on. Which, by the way, doesn't just function in that direction. For those people who are fond of pointing fingers at, you know, white people or I'm India or whatever, yeah, just bear in mind that that's also going to start jumping. So I have seen people talking about, you know, the evils of white privilege, but we must protect our African brothers and sisters. Sorry, you know, once you've established the principle with one group, it's very easy to start applying it to others.
Yeah, no, exactly. This is, and you sometimes even see it in this, is this foreigner gets a very broad brush here, and suddenly it's not just people who, you know, are illegally here from Mozambique. It also starts to become people who are legally here, and then it starts to become, well, you know, someone has come from Swaziland, or someone has come from just near Swaziland. They're a South African, but, you know, they're a Swazi.
Not really one of us.
Yeah, exactly. And this kind of creeping, mm-hmm. rolling, ever shrinking a circle of fierce nationalism, ethnic nationalism, that just ends in this kind of nihilistic, destructive mood. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly why this kind of thinking needs to be resisted. You know, obviously, illegal unemployment, it does create more competition for wages, for employment, which is very scarce in this country. So you understand why people are upset. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the reality is that the business environment is so bad that that's the main problem. There's the sort of second things we can start to deal with. The impact of immigration stuff once you actually get a growing economy. And a working police force.
I have said this before that immigration, whether legal or illegal, is a perfectly rational and respectable thing to be, you know, to have concerns about. It's a matter of public concern. Sometimes a country can imbibe or assimilate large numbers, sometimes not. And these are issues that people feel strongly about. I think that it's quite legitimate to want migrants to come in legally and to be vetted according to the country's laws. But I do think that to scapegoat them as the root causes of South Africa's problems is just, well, it's just incorrect. Now, a couple of days ago, I was speaking to a longtime friend of mine who is resident at the moment in the United States, and two interesting comments. He says that most Americans, in his experience, see politics in a very local light, much more interested in what, you know, in what happens in their own community and their own city council, as opposed to who occupies the White House, which is almost a sort of esoteric thing. The second thing is, he said that while he knows a good many people on the kind of Trump side of things, these are very decent, nice folks who can actually give you a fairly good answer. He says he is concerned that there is this kind of nativism that is developing around it. You know, that America in or America out, and someone like my associate who is running a business there employing American citizens is in that sense seen as the eternal interloper, which I think is a counterproductive attitude to have.
Right. Okay, let's move on to our next story. One of the things government has rightly touted as one of its great successes since 1994 is the rollout of various basic services to huge numbers of the population. You look at the figures, for example, who have access to piped water, and there are still people in this country, a significant number, who don't have access to piped water. But by and large, in almost every province, the number is in the 90s, close to 100%. Unfortunately, however, while this infrastructure was often rolled out, over the years, corruption, cater deployment, mismanagement, underfunding, all these problems have begun to create serious problems in the actual provision of water. So you may have the pipes, but how often do they have water in them? A recent survey has found that while the number of people with pipes in most provinces is very high, so for example, the Western Cape has 99.4% provision of pipe water, Gauteng is 99.3%, the Eastern Cape, I believe, is the lowest with 78.9%, that when you actually start looking at the number of people who have access to reliable water, that is, you know, the water's in their taps the vast majority of the time, that number drops quite significantly. Now, the number is quite high in the Western Cape. 89.5% of the population has access to reliable water. But in some provinces, that number drops as low as 57%. In Northwest, even though 95% of people have access to water supply infrastructure, only 57% have access to reliable water. In Mpumalanga, that number is even lower at 55%. And, you know, anyone who's been to rural towns in South Africa will know this. Many towns where, well, firstly, the water is sometimes not safe to drink, but more often you just don't have water a lot of the time. I know you go to places in the Northern Cape, you'll find towns that have water 4 hours a day or something like that. Terence, what do you make of this story?
Yep. The great unraveling, I'm afraid. This is what is effectively what happens when enormous stress is placed on the provision of the new at the expense of maintenance, where jobs that require technical expertise and beyond that, the technical mentorship to become proficient in maintaining them, is discarded for whatever reasons, for reasons of patronage or for reasons of racial ideology or, you know, whatever it may be. The hard sinews of a modern economy are your artisanal skills. Those, you know, for all the sort of snootiness that that we in the white collar classes might exhibit towards a plumber or a mechanic, yeah, you try work. You try living without your toilet flushing or your car that won't start. That's funny. The problem is that these have been declining, and in many respects, in the state, they have been they were purged, or they were the value of experience was not recognized. So you know a technician or an engineer with 20 or 30 years experience was paid off. Someone's put in his place who maybe has the qualifications and maybe has, you know, all the best intentions, but there's nothing that can replace those 30 years of knowing exactly where all the wires and the pipes are and which one is problematic. And for some reason, this one keeps on bursting. A lot of that was ignored. And then, of course, just the raw criminality that rips into it. You know, we've seen stories for close to two decades about towns where water pumping stations were literally underwater. They're just broken. No one knew how to fix them. Probably didn't even know that the infrastructure was there. Not a happy situation. Now, remember something: you can survive without electricity. It sucks in a modern world. I think with the new generation maybe being deprived of your Wi-Fi, you know, it can be defined as cruel and unusual or capital punishment or whatever. You try surviving without water. Clock ticks very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that ended up getting me to make the decision to move to Cape Town was being a few weeks without water. Comes a point where, you know, luckily enough, the place I was staying had like a little pool, so we could get some water from it, which made life much easier than otherwise it would have been. But, you know, even in that circumstance, when you're flushing the toilet by carrying a bucket of water from the pool, you go, you know, the Middle Ages, they sound great, but they're not so great to live in. I think.
Why do you like, you know, why do you like it's 1066 is what I say.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is also an explanation of why the ANC's sort of fortunes have been declining over the years. You know, you imagine you're someone who lives in a rural part of South Africa. Apartheid ends, the ANC comes in, they make all these promises, and, you know, pretty quickly you do see some rollout. You see people in your community getting grants, you see people in your community getting RDP houses, you get piped water, and you think, wow, this is great. ANC is very popular, gets lots of votes. Then things start to melt down. Oh, well, you know, actually the grants don't go as far as they did once upon a time. Oh, no one can find any jobs. Okay, well, you know, maybe this is just like a bug, not a feature. We're fine. Okay, now the water is no longer flowing in the pipes. Okay, now the police aren't arriving when you call them. And, you know, from that perspective, you know, those are people who are now turning to other parties, I think, for alternative answers. Sometimes those people will go and vote for a new party. Sometimes they'll vote for the DA, or sometimes they'll vote for the EFF or MK. But, you know, this is definitely part of the story as to why the ANC has begun to sort of fall away, I think. Okay. Last story. Not going to spend too long on this one. NASFAS, the funding financial aid scheme. This is for people who can't afford university. The government will pay for you, or at least originally the idea was to loan you. Then things were confused somewhat when Jacob Zuma promised everyone would get free education. And yeah, loans have all just sort of gotten a bit messed up by that decision. Anyway, the point being, NASFAS is under a big shortfall. It's not able to, it's missing significant amounts of money. And it has millions and billions of rands in debt from students who may be employed, but have not started paying back their loans. And NASFAS is now trying to get those loans paid back from former students who receive bursaries from them or loans from them. Relatively small group of people, 113 of the debtors, owe more than 500,000 rand each and cumulatively owe NASFAS 151 million rand. Another 414 have debt of between 400,000 and 500,000 and 118 million rand. Terence, what do you make of this? I mean, it's not just students. We know that South Africans in general are quite heavily in debt.
Yeah, I suspect that what's at play here is that many people viewed, not without reason, a tertiary qualification as being the as being their pathway to a middle class life. The reality of servicing a debt like that, particularly on a on an entry level salary, assuming you can get a job, and also with the, you know, various familial responsibilities, particularly African people have, you know, the so called black tax, it just means that the calls in your wallet are enormous. And it's only rational that the things with that, you know, when you start working out what to prioritize, the things that you are most likely to get away with are those that are going to enjoy the lowest priority. And I don't think there has been a huge rush of zeal to reclaim these debts. If for no other reason, be politically devastatingly unpopular. You've given someone the crack in the door to the middle class, and now you are going to go and hound them for a debt of 500,000 rand. And that's before you bought your car, your house, whatever. I think that one of the problems, though, is that, well, first of all, the economy is not growing, fast enough and providing the opportunities for these people to get into employment. And quite correct, yes, and the United States is a very similar problem. It's also been said that, you know, whereas college in America in the 1960s was affordable for blue-collar families, you know, now it's become this thing you have to have, but with dubious, you know, potential for recouping it. People are going to university often ill prepared to get degrees that may not be particularly marketable in a stagnant economy. Many, if they're able, will, you know, try and decamp for abroad. And I think South Africa also carries a big stigma against trade. There is, as I say, the hard sinews of an economy are your artisans. Yet that is something that receives distressingly little attention. I believe that South Africa would be far better served if university was a more selective process. If universities were able, you know, the other part of this is that with all the money being put into tuition fees, it's having an effect on what's available to do research, which also means that many academics then decamp or, you know, can't be bothered. The idea seems to be these become kind of glorified high schools. And that's not what a university should be.
And I think that's better. Yeah, that's for two reasons. One is that, you know, high school is not of high quality. And second, there's so much competition for jobs that people are just desperate to get anything else on their CV to boost their chances of being hired. And, you know, it's still true that university graduates have a much higher level of employment than people who don't have a university degree. But that's, you know, that's not, you know, our university graduates still have some of the highest unemployment rates in the world, I believe, for university graduates. You compare them to university graduates in other countries.
Well, you know, my sense of it, though, is that we should give more priority to vocational work or a vocational training. And I don't know how you do this, but I think we need to reorient the idea that there is something less, you know, about being a mechanic than having a BA ONS. Like I say, you know, can you fix a car?
I don't own a car.
Well, okay, I can't fix a car.
I couldn't fix a car if I owned one.
I do have a BA ONS, though.
Yes, no, I'm much better at sitting in an ivory tower in a think tank and talking about pieces of paper. But anyway. Yes, no, a distressing situation. And, you know, this once again just comes back to the themes and there's a reason we bang on about it so much. Economic growth really is the thing we need to start being able to make progress in a whole bunch of other things. It's not a cure-all, but man, would it help. And as long as we're stuck in this zero-growth environment that we seem to be doomed to until there is some sort of major political shift within the ANC, within the coalition, whatever, at least until, you know, the next election is 2029, then, you know, these problems are just going to keep accumulating. But it's important that we talk about these things now, not because we think that change is imminent right now, but because when the change comes, we need to not make the mistakes again. We need to not make new mistakes. We need to make the right choices. And that's one of the reasons, you know, we have this show, is because we believe that that's very important, that these ideas are put out there, and so that when we set up the next way of doing things in South Africa, once the sort of current, National Democratic Revolution experiment ends, we don't make the same mistakes. Anyway, any final thoughts, Terence?
Yeah, just to say that that dialogue is good. The national dialogue is a huge nonsense, but dialogue, discussion, deliberation, that is all good.
Right, right. And with that, I think, let's call it. It is, of course, Friday, so I hope everyone listening has a wonderful weekend. We shall see you all on Monday. Cheers, everyone, and have a great weekend.